Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and to everybody, a good evening. We are here tonight with Wendy Hollenbeck, and she is going to be sharing with us from her experiences with her organization, Thistle Ridge Diabetic Alert Dogs, and possibly give us a little bit of information about one of the groups she's in, the Diabetes Alert Dog Alliance, in case other folks out there with diabetes might want to link up and hook up and have people that understand what they're going through and build that community a little bit. Wendy, glad to have you on the show tonight. And
thanks for having me.
Go ahead and introduce yourself to the listeners and maybe give some brief overview of your organizations.
Okay. Well, like you said, I'm Wendy Hollenbeck. I'm out of Texas, Southeast Texas, and I have a dog training business called Thistle Ridge Diabetic Alert Dogs, and we also do a little bit of other service dog training, but that's primarily our focus. We stick pretty much with a smaller breed of dog so that we have a select market that's not met by most diabetic alert dog trainers. And we use Jack Russell Terriers, which I've been breeding for about 17 years now, about the same amount of time I've been training dogs. I'm fairly new to the service dog industry, but we're in our second year now, and we're starting to put out our first group of finished dogs. And then I'm also the vice president for the Diabetes Alert Dog Alliance, and what we do is try and bring breeders and trainers and the people that need diabetic alert dogs together in an alliance form where they can make contact, get information on the dogs themselves as far as what to look for in an organization, what to expect, and that sort of thing. And that's a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
The Diabetes Alert Dog Alliance is the 501c3?
Yes.
Okay. Now, is Thistle Ridge operating as a 501c3 or is that a for-profit organization?
Yep, we are operating Thistle Ridge as a for-profit.
Okay, great. Let me touch on some of your introduction there. You said you breed Jack Russell Terriers,
uh-huh.
And you like the smaller breeds for the diabetic alert, and that for you kind of gives a niche in the market because a lot of folks are into the bigger dogs, the golden retriever and the labs, as most of us know are quite common to service dog work.
Uh-huh.
So tell us why Jack Russell Terriers, and tell us why Jack Russell Terriers.
Well, myself, I found when I was younger, I always had larger dogs that I really enjoyed, but ran out of room for those in my life and wanted that same mentality but in a smaller package. And some friends growing up had the Jack Russells on the horse scene and that type of thing. And so I ended up getting my first one in 1996. And just love the intelligence of the breed and the spirit and the challenge of them. And it was actually that breed and that intelligence and that challenge that brought me into dog training as a professional. And from there, I started going to some of the Jack Russell Terrier events, and it just kind of snowballed. So I started breeding not too long after that. My first litter was in 1999. And then we focused on their hunting ability and on their ability to track and scent. And we turned that into, combined with, you know, selective breeding for temperament and health testing and all of the things that go into breeding a service dog, we took all of those elements and found that there was a need for a smaller dog. And when you use a breed for diabetic alert, as most people in the service dog industry understand, it's best to go with something that has more of a natural inclination towards the task that they need to do. And my dogs fit that need. Jack Russell Terriers are a challenge. They're not, you know, your typical Labrador. They're not always out to please, but it works in the sense that they have the conscious disobedience needed to stick with an alert when a diabetic is going into a state that they can't be as responsive or they're not as responsive. And the Jack Russells tend to stick with that and can keep after the person until they do what they need to do to get back on track with their blood glucose level. So it seems to be working out well. And most, you know, like you said, most times people do use the Labradors, which are wonderful. I have those too, Golden Retrievers, Standard Poodles, and combinations of those breeds to do the job. But we're finding that some people just don't want a large dog, you know, especially in schools or for smaller children, younger children, people with families that need to be very mobile, people that travel a lot on airplanes. It's just much easier to have a smaller dog. And with the hunting ability and sitting ability that we've kept in our lines of our dogs, it's worked out well, and they're doing extremely well at it. So we're pleased.
Okay. Now, your dogs, they are pretty much cross-trained as hunting dogs, as well as the diabetic alert, or do you
sort
go
of.
Either way with them?
What we do when we have a litter, because we also we train a lot, sell and train a lot of our terriers as blood tracking dogs for wounded game. In Texas, the ranching industry is huge for game ranches, and it's growing throughout the country. And we have dogs all over the country that track wounded game. And so when we have a litter, I typically will take, you know, what my needs, the reservations I need to meet, go through the litter, evaluate them, see who is more interested in the fur and the blood and the actual game of that, and who is more interested in me. And that's how we start to evaluate and split the litters down through need. So typically in a litter, I'll get maybe one or two that are extremely people-focused and still have a great scenting ability, and they still want to do the scent work. But when they get to the end of the trail, they're more worried about me than the end-game prize. And so we take that and we develop it into one or the other. So we don't actually cross-train the service dogs to do the other job. We pick them and choose them based on what they seem to be more inclined to prefer and happier to do as a job.
All right. Take a little bit of time and talk about purpose breeding service dogs.
Well, I think that what I've noticed in the industry and in the service dog industry in general is that there seems to be a misconception that you can just go get any dog that you like or want, be it a purebred dog or a shelter dog, rescue dog, or just your household pet, and train it to do a task. And I don't believe that that's true. I don't necessarily believe that there aren't dogs in all, throughout all breeds and strays, rescues, shelter dogs that don't have the ability, but I believe that if you start with a dog that's bred specifically for the traits you need for the task you're training, your washout rate is much lower and your success rate is much higher, and that saves time, money, disappointment, all of it for the client and for the trainer, because it's obviously very frustrating if you put months and months of training into a dog, and then you find out when it's a year old that it's not going to be able to do the work. And I've seen that a lot just watching different Facebook pages and listening to different people talk that have just gone into a shelter, or they've contacted me and they've got a dog without any trainer input, without any evaluation, without knowing what they're getting, and just thinking that they can have it trained because they want it to be trained. And I just don't feel like that is the most efficient way or the most responsible way to choose a service dog, whether you're training it yourself or picking it through a program.
Wow, that's a mouthful there. put on your gloves and lace your shoes up tight, put in your mouthpiece, because you'll have a whole lot of people to want to argue those points with you, as I'm sure you might have seen online.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I wanted to give you opportunity to speak on that. As you might know, I too am a purpose-bred service dog breeder.
Yes, sir.
And so, you know, I'm with you three bags full. I just like to get other people to stand up and take the blows so I don't have to. I'll stand behind you on that one.
Well, you know, it's just, like I said, I don't believe that there aren't dogs out there that have natural abilities and that you can do it. But I think that just going in and grabbing one off the shelf is never a good choice. Even with my own breed and my own breeding program, where I have six generations in of, you know, dogs bred to be a certain way, there's still puppies that don't make it, you know. And with all of the genetics behind and all of the training and all of the puppy enrichment and everything that goes into the choosing of these dogs and the parents and all of the things that we do to try and make a successful breeding, you still have dogs that won't make it. And that, to kind of put it in perspective, I think, you know, when you look at what we call a washout rate, and for people that aren't familiar with that term, it means a dog that doesn't stand up to do the job, and then you end up removing them from the program. I think they say statistically it's around 25% for a program dog. And when I look and have evaluated other dogs that weren't chosen for any traits, that were just picked, and the person just has an emotional attachment to the dog and wants it trained, that washout rate is 75 to 100%. And so when you put that blood, sweat, and tears, especially if you're doing owner training, into a dog, and you end up with a dog that won't do the job, what do you do with that dog at the end of the time? You know, you have to decide, do I want to keep this dog as a pet and start all over again with a dog that can do the job? Or do I find another home? And that's, you know, horrendous if you have had a dog and put that much work into it. So I try and make people understand that. It's not me being, you know, uppity or trying to convince them that no dog can do the job. It's me trying to save them heartache and extra work when it's not necessary.
Now, come on, let's be for real. You think your Jack Russells are the best thing in the world.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I know better, you know, but I also know that, I mean, I know hundreds of Jack Russell breeders, and I know some that have exactly what I'm looking for, and I've used those dogs in my program, and I've bought those dogs for my breeding program, and then there's others that won't do it, you know, they're just not cut out for it, or they're too wired, or they're too, their prey drive is just too high. And that's great in the breed for certain things, but for other things, it's not. And so, you know, you can compare that throughout all breeds, even Labradors. You can't have a Labrador that's field bred that all it wants to do is go after birds and expect it to be happy laying in an office for 8 hours a day. You know, so it's selective breeding throughout breeds, too. It's not even just purebred dogs or whatever. There's so many elements involved, and I just don't think people understand that.
That is super. Somebody ought to write a book about that. I'm just saying. Now, let me ask you this. This is a two-part question, and if you get lost, I'll bring you back to it.
All right.
You spoke a little bit about folks who might be interested in owner training. The first part of my question is, do you work at all with owner trainers to train a dog for them, or train them to train the dog, or however you might do it or don't do it? And do you work with dogs that are not part of your breeding program, or not part of what you went out and got from another breeding program for a certain individual?
At this point, I am not working with any owner trainers. My location is not real conducive to it, because we're not, if I were in a more urban area, I think that I would probably have a better chance at success, because I could have more interaction. But because we are somewhat rural, the travel involved to do owner training, I think, would be harder for most people and for myself. So in the right situation, I would be willing to, if it was the right client that would put the commitment and the work and the dedication into it to help save them on the cost. But at this point, I am not doing that. And so far, the dogs that I have evaluated have not met my criteria. So for people wanting to bring their own dogs in, so, you know, it's kind of the same thing. If one came in that did pass everything and showed all of the traits that I needed it to, regardless of the dog, the breed, I don't care about, you know, everything being equal. If the dog works, it works. It's been the same thing. I just haven't had one that showed either the drive or the skill or the work ethic or the obedience level. You know, there's been something that's knocked them out, if not more than one thing. So, no to both.
Okay. And this is why we're here, so everybody knows what Wendy's doing over there at Thistle Ridge. Now, let me ask you this. As far as placement of your service dogs, at what point do you place a dog into service, and what is your relationship with the people that you place a dog with?
Once we get to the point with a diabetic alert dog where it's consistently live alerting, and this is me when I say we, I mean we as in me.
I got you.
Not we as the industry, because everyone does their own thing, but once we get to the point where the dog is live alerting consistently, and it seems in my learning curve, because like I said, this is fairly new to me with my first group going out, that if we bring them back with the Jack Russells, if I bring them back in and continue to do drills with them with sample scent, it sets them back instead of moves them forward, because they've learned, once they've learned to associate the actual scent with the human, and that they're like, oh gosh, this is the smell I've been smelling for all these months, and it's coming out of this person, then we try and move ahead quickly with that. So sometimes when I've got the dog in the home, we're at the end of the training portion, but we're still doing a lot of training. So they're still doing drills on the person that the dog is working with. We're still moving ahead. We're working on night alerts. We're still working on everything that they were working on here. We're just doing it at a little bit different pace in a little bit different way. But my relationship with the family or the client is very, very close. It's a constant communication. So that's one thing I've noticed the industry seems to be lacking is follow-up. And also, I think there's a misconception that once the dog is placed as a trained dog, that the training's over. And in reality, the hard stuff is just beginning. You've given the dog all the tools that it needs, and you've given it all the skills that it needs, but you still have to communicate that to the handler, and they still have to keep that relationship up with the dog. Because as we know, dogs are extremely habitual creatures, and if they're given bad habits that are much easier to do, they're going to use those instead of the ones that they've been trained to do for, you know, 2 years. So I think that it's real important that people understand that, it's hard work, regardless of if you train it yourself or if you have it trained in a program. You still have to do work to keep the dog sharp and to keep the dog working. And as you, with a diabetic alert dog, if the dog's doing its job properly, and your A1C starts to go down, and you start to have less lows or less highs, and the dog isn't working as frequently because of that, which is the goal, then you have to do even more work with it to keep it sharp. And I've just, you know, seen different comments made about when you get a program trained dog, it's fully trained when it comes to your house. Well, it's really not. I mean, a dog is never done. You're never done learning. Humans, animals, you can always be better. And the more that they put into that, the more they're going to get. And if you don't work the dog, dogs are going to stop working.
You have me over here smiling because you're preaching my sermon right there. And I set that one up real nicely for you, real close to the net, because I knew what was coming after that question.
Uh-oh.
So every time somebody thinks about a service dog and a program-trained service dog, the idea of cost comes up.
Absolutely.
Now, you, and I love you for this, you're so bold, you're not even out there with a 501c3 nonprofit organization. You're telling people from the beginning, look, this is not a nonprofit. We have to be able to afford what we're doing here. So do me a favor and talk a little bit about cost versus value and why somebody should deal with you and your organization as opposed to maybe cut corners, save money, or attempt to save money, I put that in quotes, and train it themselves.
Well, that, you know, that comes up obviously every day and every client you talk to, and I'm very straightforward about it. I've looked into to going nonprofit, and for me at this point, I'm small. My clients, for the most part, have had great success with fundraising. They have, you know, a lot of contacts. They are active in their communities, and people love to get involved and to feel a part of something. And so for my clients, it has been fairly easy to raise the money. My dogs are $18,000. That's the price they are. You know, it's based upon a formula. We put in everything from the time out it takes to do the public access training, the obedience training, the scent training, the travel involved to do public access training, trying to think of everything involved, the equipment, the food, the veterinary care, the health testing. I mean, there's so many elements involved in it that people don't think about. They're not buying a dog. They're buying a medical equipment, a piece of medical equipment. And that piece of medical equipment needs to be fine-tuned, and it needs to be checked out, and it needs to be taken care of. I mean, it's just like any other piece of equipment. If you don't maintain it, you don't care for it, you don't feed it the, or if it's a car, for instance, and you don't give it the right fuel, you don't do the right checkups, then it's not going to perform the same. And it's the same with a dog. If you don't give it the best, then it's not going to have the advantages that it could. And so we take all of those costs into consideration when we are pricing our dogs. It could go up, it could go down, depending on, you know, all of the things that go on around us. But at this point, that's the price. If I have to travel extensively, I have a service area that I include. And then if I have to travel extensively, I do charge for expenses, straight expenses. So if I'm driving, you know, 10 hours, it's gas costs. If I'm flying, it's a plane ticket, a hotel room. I don't charge for my time. That's included in the price they're paying. But we have to cover, you know, everything that goes on while I'm away. Yeah. So we have to pay a trainer to stay here, you know, and work, someone to care for the dogs at the same level that I care for them. And when you really break it down, because I've looked at some owner training breakdowns, and people that are honest and do the same things that I do and do seek outside help from a trainer, which everyone should. Even as a trainer, I seek help from trainers. There's always something I need to know. There's always a bump in the road. So I have a network, too. Then they're telling me, and they are making it public when they're breaking down the costs of the dog, a well-bred, health-tested dog, trainer support, equipment, food, vet care, testing, all these things. They're still coming out at the end of the game between $8,000 and $10,000, and they're doing all the work. So that's when it comes down to what's more important or what do you have more of, the money or the time? And if you have a disability, do you have the energy to spend? And if you have a disability that involves psychiatric issues, can you keep that aside while you're training your dog so that it doesn't affect your dog? So there are all these things that people don't consider when they're thinking about training their own dog. And I've seen other people say that it costs them basically nothing. And I don't see how that can be true if they're doing it properly and the dog is getting the care that it needs. I just don't see how that could be, because I raise dogs. I know how much it costs to just take care of one properly, feeding it, vetting it, testing it, all of those things. So, you know, like I said, the value is, what do you want to put into it? Do you want to put in the more of the money, or do you want to put in the money and the time?
I like the way you sold that, and I think I'm going to take that sound bite, put it on my page, and say, now, there. I didn't say it. Wendy said it.
Wendy said it.
Now, you mentioned the term 2 years a couple times. Do you actually have a waiting list? And if you do, is it longer, shorter? What is it like? How does someone get on that list?
To be honest with you, I don't have a waiting list like that. The waiting list comes just in the time that they're waiting for the dog, because like I said, I haven't been in this for a long time. The industry itself right now is strange, the diabetic alert dog industry. We've received a lot of bad publicity. And even in the little town that I live in, there was another trainer here, which was odd, that was just arrested for animal cruelty. And so they were putting out 15 to 20 dogs a couple times a year with very little training help for around the same price that I'm selling my dogs for, without, you know, a lot of health testing. They weren't selectively breeding. They were purchasing. And they sold the dogs and didn't train them. And they left the dogs alone. with people to take care of them, but they weren't people that were really trained. They were people that were coming by after work or whatever, and they were doing the best they could, but the dogs were living in filth and not being worked with at all by a trainer. And that was all over the news. We have another one up north that, you know, has had a lot of lawsuits and bad publicity and fraud, and it's just, it's rampant in this industry, and it's what makes the Diabetes Alert Dog Alliance so valuable if people will use it, because it gives you the truth. It tells you the truth. I get a lot of calls from parents with newly diagnosed diabetic children, and I cannot imagine anything scarier than being told that your child might not wake up in the morning. And I understand their fear, and I understand their desperation. But when a child is first diagnosed, you've got a whole lot to learn about the disease. And if you bring a service dog into that, wow, you know, you're not only trying to learn about the disease itself and about how your child reacts to it and what medications they need and what dosing they need and how to count carbs and how to do all the things that go along with the type 1 diabetic lifestyle, and you try to add a service dog into it that's totally confused because medication keeps changing and emotions are high and low, and we don't know if the kid's, you know, going to go high and then drop really low. I mean, there's all these, you know, innuendos and little nuances with the disease that the parents don't know about yet. Bringing the dog in too soon can really make things harder. And I tell that to people. Well, it's obviously not what a parent wants to hear. They want to hear that I can give them something that's going to allow them to sleep through the night. And that's just not going to happen. Because when your child may not make it through the night, you're not going to trust anything, be it a perfectly trained dog that never misses an alert, which is, there is no such thing, or, you know, a monitor, whatever the case may be. As a parent, you're never going to sleep through the night again the same way you did before, or the same way you did before you had children. It just changes. So I tell them that. Well, then they call another company that tells them, I'm full of it. They can provide that. And they can provide it quickly, and they may be able to provide it for less money. And so the parent feeds into that because that's what they want. That's what we all would want. But it's just not the truth. And so that opens it up so easily for fraud. And people just come in and prey on these desperate and scared and exhausted parents. And that's what we're seeing in this industry. And so it makes it tough on the rest of us that do tell the truth and do say it's going to be a while. You know, we've got to start here and make it to this, you know, from A to Z. And here's all the things that go into this. And so right now, it's not a booming business. You know, unfortunately, we're suffering from this. From this fraudulent behavior, criminal activity, millions of dollars being stolen from these desperate parents and clients. And it's a little tender right now, you know. So my clients are, you know, they're selective. I get grilled, which I appreciate because I want them to be that way. I want them to check me out. I want them to talk to other people about me, my trainers, my mentors, people I've been working with. I want them to know everything and know that they can come here anytime, you know, to give me a call and I'm here. Send me a text if they need something. And we go through the journey together, and I stay small for that reason. And so we only take a few clients at a time. And we like that way. It's more like a family.
That's great. Now, it might seem like you strayed a little bit off the point, but what you did was you circled back to the question I asked before about cost and value.
Mm-hmm.
And what you did was, what I was wanting you to do, was to put it on a scale and, you know, let's weigh what you're getting when you come to someone with an ethical practice that is doing things the right way for the right reason.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really put a price tag on that.
No, you really can't.
That's the value of it.
Yeah.
Now, yes, it does cost money, but as you said, and I'm going to say it a little differently, it doesn't really cost money. It is actually saving you money because of what you're getting. What you would have to pay to get that
mm-hmm.
is something completely different. Because you can go to the shelter and grab a dog and go to Barnes & Noble and buy a book
mm-hmm.
and watch a few videos. And I put this in air quotes, train a dog and meet the requirements of the ADA. But what are you getting?
Right.
And do you have the confidence that that dog is going to give you what you're needing when you need it?
Mm-hmm. I agree. And as a professional that knows dogs and knows behavior and knows the breed that I'm working with, and, you know, I know these dogs intimately. They're born in my home for the most part. And I still hit walls every day. I still, you know, I did go through a lot of training before I touched a dog for this, before I took on a client. There are businesses that have started and put out dozens of dogs in the time since I started looking into it and training for it, because I wanted to do it the right way. And even with that much effort and that much studying and that much everything, I'm still floored daily on the little things that happen. It's just, you can't learn it from a book. You can learn principles and methods, and that's what I've got. And I feel like I have good methods, and they're easily applied. But what you think about in your head and what you get are two totally different things, especially when you're working with scent, you know. And the little things that I know about, like fear stages and hormones and all these other things, wow. I mean, the dogs have thrown me so many times, and I will be completely floored. One day everything's fine, and the next day they act like a feral dog from the woods, you know. And you just, you know, that's not your dog, but, you know, they're sentient beings. They are subject to everything, hormonal swings and mood changes, illness, and all the little things that come with being a living being. And you have to be able to work around that. You have to know when to stop and put a dog away for a little while and start back up again and not push it at the wrong time, you know, so that it gets to the point of being bomb-proof. And I don't think that everyone that tries to train a dog is capable of doing that, because they see failure where an experienced person sees normalcy. And you just have to make sure that whenever you're working with a dog, that you pay attention to those things. And that's why it takes longer. That's why you can't place a six-month-old puppy working, because you're going to hit, you know, four more stages before the dog's mature. And you can't learn that in a book. You can, somebody can try and tell you, but you can't know it, because every dog is different. They all hit things at different periods, regardless of what science tells you. And, you know, you can look like a colossal failure in a mere 30 seconds. And I've been there. You know, I've had a dog fall apart in front of a client, but we had to work it out and work it through. And, you know, she went right back to normal when everything passed. So, you know, people just can't wrap their head around that. They think that you teach a dog something and it knows it and you're gone. You're moving forward. Well, no, chances are you're going to take some steps back.
Okay. talk a little bit about your position on certification, non-certification, those issues as they are within the service dog community?
You've got some interesting timing on that. I do two things with certifications. One is through the Diabetes Alert Dog Alliance. We have formed our own certification. And the other is through the International Association of Canine Professionals. We're actually working on a certification for both trainers and for service dogs. And we had a committee meeting about that today. And it's kind of hard, you know, I sit on the fence about it as far as a regulatory item. I don't think that I want it to be government regulated, I think would be the best way to put it. I've worked for the government. I know what happens when they start regulating things. It ends up being people making rules that don't know about the actual industry. And so while I think there needs to be some serious standards in place and some very clear rules and laws, which I will give the Department of Justice credit, they did do some clear definitions this year with the ADA. But I would like to see a voluntary standard throughout the industry where we as an industry hold each other accountable and want to be certified, want to be held to a standard, and want our dogs held to a standard so that we know that the clients are getting taken care of and that there is a way to check it out without it just being somebody selling you a bill of goods like a used car. That's how I feel about certifications and standards. I think that they're good to keep us honest and keep us working towards a goal. But I don't know that I would support government standard just because I don't know how successful it would be. And our government has a lot of other things to worry about, you know, honestly.
Okay. Now I'm going to disengage from that for a minute and come back around to catch something that I might have let slip a little earlier. You are in Texas, and that's where your facility is at.
Mm-hmm.
And you do Jack Russells,
mm-hmm.
and you do diabetic alert dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question is, are you... Well, I already know a little bit about the answer to that because you touched on a little bit. Are you exclusive to those three, or do you take clients outside of Texas? I know you do or would do other dogs if need be, such
mm-hmm.
as the standard poodle for those with the allergies. And you mentioned that. But the diabetic alert, is that what you do? You're not trying to be a jack of all trades. You are into diabetic alert dogs?
For the most part, when I got into this, that was my primary focus and continues to be. However, there are needs that come up, which I have one locally, where there was a young girl or is a young girl that was younger than most programs accept and really needed the assistance of a mobility dog. And so I took that family as a client. They're very close here. A young woman that I work with that I get Labradors from, she donated a dog, and he's being trained to assist this little girl with spina bifida, and it's going very well. And those situations, I felt qualified to do it, to teach a Labrador to do the tasks that she needed is not, out of my scope. so the confidence level was there as far as my background is concerned. Now, there are other things that I don't feel qualified for, that I don't know enough about the situations. Psychiatric service dogs, for instance, I don't feel qualified to deal with that at this point. There are other people that are better at that and that specialize in that, and post-traumatic stress disorder and those types of things. So while I would train dogs for other things, especially scent-related, so allergens, peanut allergies, things of that nature, where the training would be very similar, so far it hasn't been, I haven't been approached with it. As far as distance is concerned, I prefer to stay close, just because it makes it easier on, little things. If we need to go back and forth about something at the placement point, we can ease into it where the client has the dog for maybe the weekend at first and that type of thing, getting to know all the basics of the household, and I can spend time, it's easy to go to their baseball games or to their birthday parties and things like that. It's not a major travel event. However, there are people in other parts of the country that want a dog from me and have done their research and have put forth all the effort and are willing to pay the extra travel costs and to stick with the schedule. And so when that happens, yeah, absolutely. If we can't find another trainer for them, which is usually my first goal, is to try and find another trainer that maybe I work with closely that would work with a Jack Russell, then that's my first choice. If they're far away, like I have a client in Connecticut and a client in Kansas City, but in both of those cases, we could not. And so, it came down to personalization and figuring out a plan for them. So, I'm not set ever to any one thing, but I always, I don't borrow trouble, I guess. I don't advertise nationally. I don't advertise myself as, any kind of service dog trainer. So I just try and kind of judge every situation individually, because I feel like that's the way to maintain the best relationship with the client.
Okay. Talk just for a minute, if you can, about different ideas, different ways that some of your clients have gone about fundraising. Maybe you have some fundraising ideas that you don't mind sharing, so that somebody might be able to see, okay, well, that's doable. I can do that.
Oh, absolutely. We've done so many things. It's run the gamut. I have one client, my client in Kansas City. They were so fortunate. They had a family friend that owns an architectural firm, and they took the little boy on as their fundraising project for the year. And so they did a campaign where they raised, they challenged the employees to raise so much money, and then they would match that up to a certain amount. And then once they hit that goal, which happened within the first week of the campaign, they went outside to partner businesses that they worked with and raised the rest that would cover the travel and everything else. So that was phenomenal. In 2 weeks, they raised $20,000. So that's, the ultimate best case scenario. But my other clients, it's a little bit of a struggle, and it's work. But that's another thing that it comes down to, is how bad do you want this? Are you willing to work? Because if you're willing to work, I'm willing to do whatever I need to help you. I'm willing to come to bake sales, bingo games, anything. And that's what we've done. We've had bingo fundraisers, one that raised about $7,000 just one night. Everything was donated, but it took a lot of work to get that to happen. But then it was just that it was there, cash money, bake sales, same thing. In a few hours, they raised $1,500. I've had another one raise $500. Barbecue sandwich sales, where you just go throughout the community and tell them you're going to have a plate lunch on Friday and how many do they want, you know, and businesses love that, having their lunch delivered to them on a weekday. I'm trying to think of all the things, fun runs, color runs, golf tournaments, bike races, festivals. Gosh, I'm just trying to think of all the things that they've done, and they're so creative. Oh, quilt raffles. That's huge for us sometimes. And interestingly enough, I mean, I'm not alone, or they're not alone in this, because when I decided to do this, the Jack Russell community that I've been a part of for so long decided they were going to fund this, and we auctioned on Facebook, and we sold quilt tickets, and we did all of these things, and by doing so, we were able to raise enough money to send me to training multiple times, fly me where I needed to go, pay for the training classes, build a training building facility specially made for these diabetic alert dogs. We did all that in 6 months. So I've been there myself. I wouldn't be able to do this full time like I do if I hadn't had people behind me and we hadn't worked our tails off to get here. So fortunately, I have a fundraising background. That's how I started. That's what I started in out of college, and I'm able to help, you know, do that. But they've got to want to do it. You know, if they don't want it bad enough, it's not going to happen. And I've seen that too. I've seen failures. And that's not fun, but you've got to be prepared, and you've got to want to do the work, and you've got to get people behind you, and you can't be afraid to ask. That's the biggest, you know, thing. People don't want to ask, but they don't. What they don't know is that people really want to help. And yeah. Lions, you know, Lions clubs down here. That diabetes is big for the Lions Club. They do camps. Because they have, you know, the seeing eye, and it kind of goes hand in hand. Or one of the guide dog schools, civic groups love to do this kind of stuff. Churches, you know, there's just so many options, but people have to be willing to ask and do the work, and it will come.
Yes, indeed. There you go again, saying it so that I don't have to. I always love getting other people to say what I've said, so that people who have maybe went tone deaf to me because of being too close in the relationship,
right,
can hear other people say it. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing. Now, let me ask you this. Having said all that you've said, somebody wanting to work with you and get one of your dogs, how do you qualify the client?
Well, like I kind of touched on earlier about people that I won't take, and but I didn't hit it real close, or I was real broad about it. You know, very newly diagnosed, I don't want them focusing on getting a service dog. I want it to be almost the last tool in their toolbox. I want them to get everything else settled first. I want to see compliance in their self-care. I want to see that they're doing everything that they can to make sure that they've got the tools that they need, the resources that they need to, you know, do the best that they can for their body. And then we bring in the service dog to pick up that slack when they go unaware for hypoglycemia, which is almost all of my clients, is why they need the dog. They just can't feel it. So that's the starting point. You know, where are you, or where is your child in the process? And is this even something that you need to be worried about raising money for right now when you have all these other things? The next thing is, it's personal. You know, how do we feel about each other? Are you comfortable with me? because I'm going to be taking a lot of your money and a lot of your time. And am I comfortable with you because we're going to be spending a lot of time together over the next 10 years or so. And I want to make sure that, you know, we click, that we can sit down and have a meal together and have a good time, you know, on top of this, because it's a personal, to me, it's a very personal journey. And that's what sets me and some of the people that I work with apart from the bigger trainers, because it is so very personal to me. And I do this for a very, very specific reason and a personal reason, and I want that conveyed through all of my relationships. Once we, you know, talk, get through all that, I want to make sure that they understand the process, that they understand what the expectations are, and that's all spelled out in writing for both me and them, to protect both of us, to protect the dog. And then I want to make sure that it is from, you know, both a medical perspective, psychological perspective, a very real need, desire, and want, so that they have all the components to get this dog and to make it a successful relationship. So it's not a simple answer, really. I mean, you know, they fill out an application, but there's a lot more that goes into it than that. And unfortunately, I have to turn down a lot more people than I get to work with.
Okay, now, with your turn downs of people, do you feel like at any point, I'm sure you feel like you need to educate the people, but do you refer to maybe other folks that maybe can help them?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I've actually got to that point. If it's a lot of times it's just not the right decision yet, or it's not the right tool. You know, I believe that the like I said earlier when we were talking about the actual training part of it, I think the way that you see a service dog in your head and how it will be to have one and the reality of it are so very different. And it seems like it would be such a neat thing to have a dog and to take it out everywhere you go, all the time, and a constant companion. But what you don't think about is when it's raining and you got to take the dog out at 30 degrees and the dog has to use the restroom and it doesn't want to go. You know, you don't think about if you're a child, you don't get to go to recess anymore. You have to take the dog, make sure it's had a drink, give it a little exercise, do what you need to do. Its needs come before yours, except when your needs are needing to be met, you know, by the dog. I think that's the, watching my clients, that's the biggest reality when the light bulb comes on, that it's not all fun and easy and neat. When you have to go through Walmart and 15 people want to stop you and talk to you about your dog and touch your dog and do all the things that they can't, and it takes twice as long to do anything. You know, it takes a while for that realization to hit, and once it does, some people don't want to continue on, you know. I try to make that clear beforehand, you know. I try to let them understand that from the beginning, that this is not rainbows and unicorns. This is a lot of work. You know, you have a disease, and now you also have a dog to deal with, and it's not always fun. And if that realization comes to them, there is no referral, because there's nowhere else for them to go at this point on the dog end.
Right.
You know, with, like I said, with other disabilities, sometimes, yes, if I don't do the work, I will try my hardest to find a reputable trainer that will help them. And if I know that they're looking at a bad service dog training, I will try and steer them away, you know. By bad, I mean fraudulent. I don't want them to get heartbroken and I don't want them to put their money into something that's just going to let them down and make their life and their stress level higher. I mean, it's already hard enough. So I think I spend more time because of my association with the Diabetes Alert Dog Alliance trying to educate people on what to look for in a good trainer, and trying to keep them on track and trying to make them know exactly what they're getting into so that they're not overwhelmed and disappointed any more than they're going to be when reality hits.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have come right up on the hour, and I am going to give you an opportunity to plug anything you want to plug or say anything that we didn't get to that you wanted to make a point of. But before that, I want to let the listeners know that they can call in at 646-668-2499 if you have a question that you might want to ask or a comment. And you can do that now. And once you dial and get in, press the number 1 on your phone's keypad, and that will let me know that you're calling in with a question or a comment. You can do that now while Wendy makes some closing remarks. And if we don't get any of those, then we'll go ahead and close out the show.
All right.
Wendy, the floor is yours, and make sure you give some contact information in case anybody wants to contact you.
Okay. First thing I want to talk about that I didn't get to as much as I wanted to is the actual Diabetes Alert Dog Alliance. Like I said, it is a nonprofit organization. It's strictly for information and educational purposes, and we do have a trainer listing. That trainer listing is not it's not absolute as far as us going out and, you know, certifying anyone or anything of that nature. But we do have an application process. We do have certain things that we look for as far as the quality of dogs that they are putting out. How are they screening? What is their experience? What training are they, you know, have they had? Are they going through that type of thing? What is their process? You know, things of that nature. And then also the certification process for the diabetic alert dogs, where we certify them in public access and the scent training process and obedience, so that the client feels good that their dog is trained to do what it's supposed to. So those two things in the alliance are really big and special to us, and we want to promote them as much as we can. And also just the alliance itself, it's diabetesalertdogalliance.org, and they people can go to that website and get information, frequently asked questions, trainer referrals, all of that stuff. Then as far as my contact information, you can always find me on Facebook, Thistle Ridge Diabetic Alert Dogs. Also, my website is thistleridgeterriers.com. Phone numbers are on both sites, email, Facebook, whatever. I'm pretty easy to find through my name and through my my business name.
Well, all righty then. Well, I'm glad that you did circle back and bring up the Diabetes Alert Dog Alliance, because we didn't touch on that too much, and it was advertised, so we do have to give what is advertised.
And we'll have to get another member on one night to talk more about it, or I can come back on or whatever, because it is a great organization, and we're trying to really promote it and get people to start educating themselves and looking into their trainers, be it, you know, diabetic alert dogs or any service dog. I think it's so important to be educated and to really look into the background of who you're dealing with, whether they're nonprofit or for profit. You know, it's just, it's so important to getting what you're paying for or being promised, and yeah. and that it's a safe and working dog.
Especially in this world of so many different types and kinds of certifications, if you will,
right.
that really are only as good as the people giving the certification.
That's absolutely the truth. That is absolutely.
And so folks have to look deeply and consider more options than just the price issue.
Mm-hmm.
They got to look at what they're actually getting and from whom they're getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not received any calling calls.
Well, good. That means nobody wants to yell at me. So
you are getting off easy tonight. And the folks that just want to let you have their peace of mind without being on air, they can send you a message and let you know. But I am glad that you were able to give your information so that people can indeed, you know, reach out to you.
Mm-hmm.
They might not want to get one of your dogs, but they might want to have some information on who might be closer to them or
Absolutely.
Who might work with a different dog breed of their choice.
Mm-hmm.
Or who might give them what they want, because you won't.
That's what we're here for. I mean, you know,
some
my main objective is for people to find what the best fit, whatever that might be. And if it's not me, then we will certainly try and help them find that.
Yes, indeed. And I will say to you publicly in front of God and everybody, don't forget to put my information in your little box.
Okay.
We don't do the diabetes, but I think, you know, we do a lot of the scent work because of our kids needing that.
Mm-hmm.
This is not my time. This is your time. So we're going to let you be the highlight and the feature. And I want to thank you for coming on tonight. Maybe you'll have your president of your Diabetes Alert Dog Alliance get in touch with me on Facebook, and we'll let the president do the president's job and promote the group.
That sounds excellent. I'm sure she'd be glad to.
I will definitely make a space for her and give her some time to toot the horn of the group and anything else that she might want to toot her horn about. And I want to thank everybody for listening and thank everybody for supporting this broadcast, because we cannot do it without you. So having said that, I want you to be good to yourselves, good to one another. Show love to your animal, and your animal will love you back.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.